Okay, the next and last matter on our calendar today is docket number 61584, Sharp versus State. You'll notice that Justice Hardesty isn't with us today. He couldn't make it in a conflict with his calendar that didn't allow him to be here, but he's listening to the webcast. We have a live webcast, and he will participate in the deliberations. So, counsel, are you ready?
The appellant is ready, Your Honor.
Very good. Let's go. And would you like to reserve any time?
Yes, sir. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, although I might not use all of that.
No reply.
What's that?
No reply.
Oh, there was no reply? Okay.
May I approach this podium, Your Honor?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Mr. Justice Barabay. Good afternoon, Ms. Justice Bob. Your Honor, preliminarily, I'm asking if the court has any particular questions to be addressed today.
Well, let me do this. There's a whole lot in here. There's a whole lot that we've reviewed. There's a number of issues that you've raised. What are the most compelling for you?
The most compelling, Your Honor, would be if I could start on issue number 3. This is where there are two sub-issues, whether the trial court properly conducted the appellant's trial. The first point is, Your Honor, is that the state is arguing, and the defense counters, that the court had no duty, there was no duty upon the district court to inform the appellant of a right to continue the arraignment or to continue the trial. Now, the sequence of events is this. In July of 2011, there was an indictment which charged a number of offenses relating to kidnapping, coercion, living off the earnings of a prostitute, living with a prostitute, etc. On September 13th, 2011, 6 days before the trial, the state obtained a superseding indictment. The superseding indictment added several charges involving stolen cars, or parts of stolen cars, the cars of which were found at the Gagnier residence. This is a residence which the state has argued was attributable to Mr. Sharp, and where they say he was living because of various articles which were found inside the Gagnier residence at the time of the subsequent search of the premises. Now, that left 6 days before the trial. The arraignment was on the 16th of September, 3 days after the superseding indictment had been filed, but no transcript had yet been received. Now, I cannot dispute that the district court asked the questions, you plead guilty or not guilty, to the superseding indictment, which added substantive counts. It wasn't like an amendment because of a typographical error or because there was a particular point which should have been in the original indictment but was left out inadvertently. This added 6 additional counts. Now, the counts which were added had nothing to do with the kidnapping and the coercion and the living off the earnings of a prostitute. These were cars. They could have been in a separate indictment, but they weren't. Now, on the 16th, when the arraignment was going on, it was a very short arraignment, the district court did ask the defendant, you know, how do you plead, not guilty? And then there was a discussion from the court. Have you had a chance to review this? If I'm wrong.
Uh-huh.
Have you had a chance to review these charges? The appellant's counsel answered, we had a little time to discuss these charges. Now, it's true there was discovery, which had been provided to the defense concerning the Chop Shop organization, which was going on at that house, according to the state's theory. But no formal charges had been filed. So we're left with a trial, which is occurring in a few days. The defendant says, you know, I want to go to trial. Now, while the district court, in many cases, allows the defendant to go ahead and proceed, I believe that in this case, Your Honor, the district court had the statutory duty to look to see if there was some possible prejudice here, if it appeared that a joinder would prejudice the defendant. And that's at NRS 174.165. It's on pages 15 and lines 15 and 16 of page 28 of the state's brief. So the question then becomes, these cases have nothing to do with each other in the sense of they did not operate out of a common nucleus of facts, although it just happened to be that the cars were there. And I understand that, okay, let's go ahead and supersede the indictment, but there were substantive offenses for which the defense counsel only acknowledged he didn't have a transcript, therefore, you know, I'm not going to be able to file a writ. But the statute, NRS 174.165, makes it incumbent upon, the judge to exercise discretion whether to settle the offenses if it appears that the joinder would prejudice the defendant. So in this statute, it does not say, okay, the defendant must always make the motion to settle. When the state says, well, you should have filed a motion for severance. But in this case, Your Honor, under the statute, the complainant statute, Nevada Revised Statute 174.123, you must bring a motion for severance within 15 days from the date set for trial or 5 days from entry of plea. There wasn't even enough time under the statute. Granted,
but there was no motion for severance made at all, and you're saying the court sua sponte was required to address that. Where do you find authority exactly for that?
And let me piggyback on that question. The
yes,
state, on the page before the one you referenced, page 27, sets out the question and answer between the court and defense counsel, in which the defense counsel says, so he's prepared to waive his right to file a writ at this point and proceed to trial on Monday morning. And then the court addresses itself to the defendant. And then the defendant says, this is what he wants to do. You want to proceed with trial rather than waiving your right to trial within 60 days. Right. What do you do with that? I mean, there's an affirmative waiver on the record. Not only was there no motion to sever, but there's an affirmative waiver.
That is an excellent question, Your Honor. But I think that what the defendant was facing in this case, and it had been known all along prior to trial, was a life sentence or possible multiple life sentences based on the habitual criminal statute, not to mention the first-degree kidnapping charge. So in this case, the question is, what's the hurry? The man's already in trial. We haven't got the transcript. The transcript wasn't filed until October. So I understand that there was this waiver, but I do not believe that the waiver was informed because of the timing of the events. Superseding indictment on the 13th of September 2011, the arraignment on the 16th, trial on the 19th on the substantive matters. So I think that the statute that is, and then of course we have the statute which says that you can't bring the motion for severance unless it's 15 days before trial or filing order shortening time. Mr. Justice Paragraph points out also a relevant point. There wasn't a motion for severance. I have no explanation for that. And of course, we're not here arguing ineffective assistance of counsel. What I'm arguing is from the facts, perhaps that the district court, for which we have the utmost respect, should have come back a little bit, slow the train down, and say, look, you need to go back and talk about this. Let's at least get the transcript. Well, they have to discover, but let's at least get the transcript, because then at trial, there could have been meaningful cross-examination.
That goes back to Justice Pickering's other question and the colloquy between the court and the defendant himself as to waiving the right to get the transcript because he wanted to maintain and preserve his speedy trial rights. And so that's a hard argument for me.
Yes, it is, Your Honor. I admit that. And that's why we came out of the gate with that issue, because it is virtually impractical by the statute, unless it was an order shortening time, the prejudice to the defendant, there would be no prejudice to the state. It had already got its superseding indictment on now 3 days before the arraignment. The prejudice to the defendant is not having sufficient material by which to proceed to trial, although there is this waiver that Justice Pickering has noted in the state's brief. The only answer I have is that the district court should have exercised its discretion. I realize that this area of discretion, the judge can be wrong, the judge can be right, but still be within that area of discretion and still be upheld by this court, as this court has done on hundreds of occasions in the past 149 years. Do you have any other questions pertaining to this matter?
What about the sufficiency of the evidence to support the convictions on living with a prostitute and the difference? I'm not clear in my mind on the difference between the dates in the indictment and the dates proven, if it was proven at trial.
The incident in question was on July 2nd of 2011. The search of the residence occurred on the 2nd and I think a few days after there were searches. As to the living off the earnings of the prostitute, that came from Alicia Grundy, who said, well, I give him $30,000 or $40,000 at a time, or I give him the money. Now, we don't have any receipts. We don't have, and not only was there living off the earnings of us.
On this type of business, do you usually see receipts?
Of course not. Of course not, Your Honor. And it was my client's house. That blends into the other issue of Fidel Green. This is the issue of the trial court's preclusion of Mr. Fidel Green being a witness, although the state's response, and Fidel Green would have testified, I was there. The state's response is that we have tape recordings from the defendant in the jail, and the state has made a point of this, stating in essence that we have, Fidel Green was there. Now, there were some differences, in slight differences on what the clothing was by this African-American male who was dragging this Alicia, I won't mention her last name, but Alicia into the residence. As to the point of living off the earnings of the prostitute, I do not believe that was proved beyond a reasonable doubt, appellant believes it was not proved beyond a reasonable doubt. Why? Alicia gives conflicting testimony at the time of trial when she's called as a witness for the defense. She's called by the state during its case in chief. So that was a question which left to the jury. And I think that in this case, there was no sufficient evidence on living off the earnings of a prostitute. There was no evidence of living with a prostitute.
That was my question. He was also convicted of living with a prostitute.
Yes, and there was no evidence whatsoever that there were prostitution-related activities going on in that house.
Is that required by the statute?
I understand it's not required by the statute, but I think that there should be affirmative evidence that you were, in fact, living off those earnings.
That's not the charge. That was a separate and distinct charge. Living with a prostitute under the statute, under 1E, is a separately distinct charge. Living with a prostitute.
I understand that.
My understanding is you were challenging the fact that he wasn't living with her.
That is correct.
Not the fact that her status as a prostitute.
That is correct. That's why that there's insufficient evidence as to those particular two issues, which are distinct but still related to each other. Does the court have any other questions?
Not I.
Indulge me for just a moment, Ron.
You may reserve the balance, I think.
You've got a minute and a half.
Then I will take a seat, Your Honor, if the court has no further questions.
Okay.
In terms of the ballot with them. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Justice. May it please the court, my name is Noreen DeMonte. I was one of the trial counsel in this case, and I'm representing the Straight Up State of Nevada today. Let me start with something that Mr. Green stated that was somewhat important to me and struck out in my mind. As he said, that the charges had nothing to do with each other. The state couldn't disagree more. And let me, if I could, give you a snapshot of how this case unfolded. Mona Temple called 911 to report that her naked neighbor, who appeared to be bleeding from the head, was hiding on her front porch and ringing her doorbell. She then said, well, I think she might be wearing a thong or a bikini or something like that. But Alicia Grundy was naked. She then handed the phone off to her husband to go upstairs and get dressed. What she sees as she's getting dressed upstairs is her neighbor, Raymond Sharp, and she calls him her neighbor, grab Alicia Grundy by the hair after Alicia gets no response from the Temple's home and goes across the street to the other house and is hiding behind a pillar from Mr. Sharp, from their neighbor. Goes over there, grabs her by the hair, takes her back into the house. Thomas Temple testified the exact same way, told the 911 dispatcher, it's my neighbor, he's taking her back into the house by her hair, the door's nailed shut, you need to send police out here. The police arrive, Matt Kovacic gets there, he gets there in response to the initial call that she's naked banging on the door. As he approaches the house, the first thing he notices are all of these cars. And one car in particular would be Mr. Sharp's Mercedes-Benz parked halfway out into the middle of the street. Now, part of that's because there's so many cars in that driveway. So he started looking around the cars when he gets updated that she has now been dragged back inside the residence. So he goes up to the front door, notices that the door handle is missing and that there seems to be no way to get in the front door, and could hear something going on behind the door. He's then updated about her status. He starts to head back to his car when he hears something along the side of the house. And the house sits on a corner and is surrounded by a block wall like you would see in every single neighborhood in Clark County, Nevada, with that 6-foot concrete block wall. Hears something from that area where the only thing over there is that concrete block wall, and sees a naked Alicia Grundy bleeding from her head, who has no way of getting to him other than to jump that block wall. Naked, bounding over that block wall, screaming, get out of here, he's got a gun. He then places her in the back of his patrol car and makes his way to the back. The second officer on scene sees him right after he's placed her in the patrol car and then sets up a perimeter around the house. They are now updating dispatch as Alicia Grundy, who is trembling and crying and screaming, starts talking about Raymond Sharp, her pimp. Raymond Sharp, the father of her child, Raymond Sharp coming to her house, confronting her about a new boyfriend. Now, Detective Chris Boffman gave some very important testimony about pimp prostitute subculture. Prostitutes don't have boyfriends. They don't. It's just not allowed. It's not something in that subculture. It's not something that, first of all, a boyfriend would tolerate to be dating a prostitute. Let's just use common sense there. Boyfriends aren't going to do that. You're not going to date a prostitute. It's not going to happen. But the second thing is, what is most important to those pimps is to keep control over these girls. And you cannot keep control over a girl if she's got a boyfriend. And Alicia Grundy, crying and trembling, tells Officer Kovacic he's confronting her about this. He makes her call that new boyfriend on the phone. And he's yelling at that man on the phone and screams at him, is she giving you money? And that is very, very important in the pimp prostitute subculture. Giving another man money means that he is suspected of being another pimp. In this particular case, it is the state's theory of the case, and we believe the jury believed that to be the truth, that Mr. Sharp believed that Alicia Grundy had found herself another pimp and was angry. He then pistol whips her with a firearm, according to what she told detective after detective after detective, who responded to the scene. Ray Sharp is then seen running through the desert area, I think in a westerly direction off toward Durango, wearing the same clothing described by Thomas and Luna Temple. He's apprehended by police officers at that scene. She tells Officer Nolan during his taped interview that he did go to the house to confront Alicia, did go to the house to confront Alicia about a man, but it was a man that he says was threatening his life. So he admits he made a phone call to this man, to Officer Nolan. Then other police officers arrive on scene. They notice as they're going through the cars to determine whether or not they're stolen, to determine whether or not they belong to other pimps, because that was another part of this investigation, was two of Ray Sharp's cars were found at Micah Duncan's residence, who was known to be another pimp during that investigation. They start investigating that. Not only does Alicia Grundy tell Officer Matt Kovacic what happens while she's under that state, not only does she tell the vice detectives the same thing while she's under that state, she tells the Viper detectives, and Viper is Metro's Auto Theft Initiative. It is part of the same investigation. Search warrants conducted by the Auto Theft Initiative detectives uncovered the firearms found in the residence, uncovered the blood found in the residence. This was all part of the same investigation and the same case. And it was the defendant, Raymond Sharp, who was pushing this to go to trial. It was the defendant, Raymond Sharp, who wanted to go to trial. And the reason for that is simple. He had control of Alicia Grundy at that point in time. When we were up against that 4 days after the superseding indictment, the state of Nevada had no idea where Alicia Grundy was. We were trying to find her. Detective Boffman was texting her on our request to try to locate her. Our investigators couldn't find her. She gave false information to personnel in our office. We didn't know where she was. Raymond Sharp, the defendant in this case, knew that and wanted to force this to go to trial. It was the state that was actually scrambling around trying to do everything at the last minute in this particular case. We were eventually able to find Alicia Grundy. She did get on that plane and then lied to us again about where she was, where she was staying. We had to get a material witness warrant for her and arrest her. We delivered opening statements to that jury saying, we have no idea what Alicia Grundy is going to say. But defendant's counsel knew what she was going to say. Defendant was controlling this from the jump, and that is what happens in these cases time and time and time again.
And the point, I guess, the whole issue was discussed. The court discussed it with counsel and with the defendant in the sense that he wanted to maintain his speedy trial rights, and
yes,
that therefore, essentially, there's a waiver of any defect in not getting the transcript.
He absolutely
did.
And
that was explained.
He absolutely did. That was laid out by Judge Kadish. And
what's your position on the motion to sever and that the district courts should be required sua sponte to analyze and look for any prejudice?
Absolutely not. First of all, I do not believe that is in the purview of what a judge not only should be responsible for. He's hired an attorney. He's hired an attorney to do what he wants. This attorney was doing what Mr. Sharp wanted. That's what those attorneys are there for. I don't believe the judge has any authority whatsoever on her own to determine that things should be continued against a defendant's right to a speedy trial, which he had invoked in this particular case. Judge Kadish had absolutely no right to, on her own, violate his right to a speedy trial and sever any portion of that case except what was agreed upon to be severed, which were those firearm counts. So I do not believe the court has any authority whatsoever to do that, and I don't believe the court should be in the business of doing that. That is the attorney's job.
Let me switch gears here to the conviction of living with a prostitute. And living off the earnings of a prostitute. There's a challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence as to all the first nine counts, but focusing on those two, could you tell me what evidence precisely supports the convictions on those two counts and do it separately?
Sure. As for living with a prostitute, and as the court pointed out, they are two completely separate and distinct statutes. All the NRS has delineated that we need to prove is that he knowingly resided with a prostitute, knowing that she was engaging in this activity. Now, the uphill battle the state faces on this case, as in every pandering case, and as Detective Boffman laid out, is these pimps do not live at one place at one time. What Detective Boffman did say was that Raymond Sharp was tied to at least two other known prostitutes, Heather Waite, Natalie Buckles. They both had children with Mr. Sharp, which goes in line with how that works in that subculture, that they will stay 3 to 4 days with this prostitute, then move on to this one, then move on to that house. Part of this is to make it difficult for law enforcement to tie them to that particular residence. But what worked in the state's favor in this particular case is Mona and Thomas Temple called him their neighbor, not the guy that owns the house that we see once in a while. He's our neighbor. They told 911 that. They told the police that.
But they also said, didn't Tom also say he didn't know if he lived there or not?
You know, what he said was he didn't know if he was living there all the time or not, because I did review the transcript again to double-check that. Not only was there that, but he was also stating that they also found numerous things. There were men's clothing in the closet, men's shoes in the closet. The defendant had packages delivered there, not only to himself in his own name, Raymond Sharp, but to his alias, Rashad Shelton. There was tax returns. The house is in his name. There was numerous paperwork delineating his possessory interest in this house. And additionally, I feel I would be remiss if I didn't point out to this court that the firearm counts were severed. And that was a completely separate trial. And I cannot, it's not part of the record in this case, so I cannot disclose to you what came out as far as those counts were concerned, but I would urge this court not to make any decisions about what the state ultimately proved regarding his ownership or anything about this case until you read the entire record as a whole, including the trial transcript in the other case, as they do relate to each other and what the items were that were located in the house. There was a lot of things, and not only that, but the firearms that are not Alicia's, that she had told the detectives were Raymond Sharp's, all over that house. One tucked behind the couch cushions, one found in the stairs, one found in the nightstand, one found upstairs in the bedroom. All of those things were Mr. Sharp's. The clothing was Mr. Sharp's. Everything in that house was Mr. Sharp's or Alicia Grundy's. And so we do believe we satisfied telling this jury that, yes, Mr. Sharp, although he wasn't living there on a day-to-day basis, he was there. He was living with her. Maybe not every day, all day, but that's not what the statute requires us to prove. Now, as far as living from the earnings of a prostitute, Alicia Grundy told the detective...
Let me just pause you there, though. Was there some discrepancy between the time period within which the indictment charged him of living with a prostitute and what the evidence suggested on that point?
I know we established, and I forgot to bring the indictment with me, and I went rifling through it, and I took three boxes and narrowed it down to a short set. I know we charged a date range. I didn't see this question coming, so I didn't bring it with me. But I know there was a date range that Ms. Mosher and I believed encompassed any question that would come up there.
Okay. Please go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's okay. With respect to living off the earnings of a prostitute, again, it is very, very difficult. They don't give receipts. Oh, you know, Alicia Grundy gave me $30,000 for her prostitution activities. But what we can show is that Mr. Sharp took from her on any number of occasions between $30,000 and $40,000. That within a few months prior to this, Alicia Grundy told detectives she paid him $40,000 to get out, to buy back her freedom and get out of the game. And what Mr. Sharp then did with that when he became angry was he told her she wasn't done yet. Now, the statute's unclear as to whether or not the state has to prove what the defendant does with this money. But she is providing him that money. Aside from the all-in-one motor company, which we know for a fact from this jury's verdict, which has now been unchallenged, was a bogus shell company set up to hide a chop shop, he had no other legitimate source of income. He had no legitimate source of income, and Detective Baldwin testified as to that, which is what the pimps do. They don't have bank accounts. They don't have anything. We are left with the statement of Alicia Grundy saying, I've given him $30,000 to $40,000. The house is in his name. Alicia Grundy, from her services as a prostitute, by her own testimony, which I'll tell you, she lied her face off throughout that entire trial, but I think what we were able to, the little smidge we were able to corroborate of her testimony, was that she was paying Bank of America directly for Raymond Sharp's house. She even provided that herself when she came back with her evidence of broken glasses and all that stuff, because family members contacted her and told her she needed to come back. So she herself is saying that she's paying for Raymond Sharp's house, and she has no other job. She is a prostitute. He's living off those earnings. So we do believe we've proven that to the jury at this point in time. What else would you like me to go in my 30 seconds?
Perhaps you could discuss the text messages between her and the detective and whether those needed to be disclosed and their non-disclosure prejudiced the defense.
I don't know if it was necessarily briefed that way as a non-disclosure or discovery issue, because what became abundantly clear to us when Detective Baughman was on the stand was that defendant's attorney knew about these text messages because he specifically asked, Mr. Stein specifically asked, am I permitted to keep going?
Yes, please answer the question.
Okay, Mr. Stein specifically asked Detective Baughman about a certain text message that said, well, you told her that you hated Mr. Sharp. Now, with regard to the text messages themselves, the state doesn't have them. They were Detective Baughman's cell phone number. We don't get cell phone records from detectives. A, because we believe they're investigating multiple crimes at one time, and so to just disseminate those freely. Specifically, in this case, we are worried about witness intimidation. Specifically, in this case, we are worried about witness intimidation. It had certain information, but it became very clear to us that discovery was not an issue. Disclosure wasn't an issue because Alicia Brunney herself freely had given those to Mr. Stein. And so I don't believe that that's essentially an issue in this case. Whether it pops up in another investigation, that would be one thing, but we ourselves had asked Detective Baughman keep in contact with her, because in these cases, victim maintenance, as Detective Baughman testified to, is very important. These guys get out of custody, their family members start trying to control this woman again. We are talking about a woman who got away from him, he shot at her. Got away from him, he ran her car. Got away from him, he flew up to Portland, Oregon, took her little sister out for ice cream, and gave her a call to get her to come back. So victim maintenance is highly important, and unfortunately, these victims, we're talking about a woman who met her first pimp. We believe that to be Ray Sharp. That's what she told detectives. At the age of 17, when she had just lost her basketball scholarship and thought her world was crumbling around her. Prostitution is the only adult life she has ever known. Unfortunately, that means she's used to being spoken to in a certain way. And as much as we cringe when we read those text messages, that is how these detectives have to get that job done. And I don't believe there was anything foul, undue, or wrong about the way Detective Baughman handled that witness. And with that, I will submit it to your discretion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I may, I'll be very brief.
Madam Justice Pickering and Mr. Justice Paragraph, you both asked questions concerning, you know, what the court could have done. On page 28, line 15 through 16, the state concedes as follows, quote, additionally, a fair reading of the statute grants the court discretion to sever offenses if it appears that a joinder would prejudice the defendant, end quote. As to the questions posed by Madam Justice Pickering, just a moment ago on the text messages, on July 27, 2011, Detective Baughman, who is this protector of Alicia Brunney, texts, quote, what's up, beautiful? You look that song up? The next day, quote, I'm going to kick your butt, Alicia, end quote. Alicia responds, why? Response from the detective, love you, talk to you later. On the 3rd of September, now 16 days before trial, from the detective, quote, and this is on page 27 of our opening brief, a quote, Alicia, you're helping him. He is an evil man. He tried to destroy you. He did kidnap you. The moment he dragged you by your hair into the house, that's the definition of kidnap. I'm hurt, but I guess it really doesn't matter now. That was at 9:02 a.m. on September 3rd, 2011. Now, approximately about 30 seconds later, if I may finish my point, Your Honor?
Yes.
The kidnap is anytime someone takes you somewhere you don't want to go, by force, sweetheart. You ran from the house. He dragged you back into it by your hair, babe. And then again on September 3rd, as to Miss Brundy, go have fun. You know I love you. You're giving me gray hairs, but I love you. Thank you very much for submitting, unless you have any questions.
No, I don't have any questions.
Thank you.
Very good. Counsel, we appreciate the arguments today. We appreciate you being here. This matter will stand submitted.